that he had been fathered on her not through that natural process, but had been blotted onto and out of her body by the old infernal immortal male principle of all unbridled terror and darkness, in which he stood looking at the innocent face of the youth almost 10 years his junior, while one part of him said, "My brow, my skull, my jaw, my hands," and the other said, "Wait, wait, you can't know yet. You cannot know yet whether what you see is what you are looking at or what you are believing. Wait, wait." The letter which he— It was not Bonn he meant now, yet again Quentin seemed to comprehend without difficulty or effort whom he meant. Wrote, maybe as soon as he finished that last entry in the record, into the daughter, 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 while he thought, by all means he must not know now, must not be told before he can get there, and he and the daughter. Not remembering anything about young love from his own youth, and would not have believed it if he had, yet willing to use that too, as he would have used courage and pride, thinking not of any hushed wild importunate blood and light hands hungry for touching, but of the fact that this Oxford and this Sutpens Hundred were only a day's ride apart, and Henry already established in the university, and so maybe for once in his life the lawyer even believed in God. "My dear Mr. Sutpen, the undersigned name will not be known to you, nor are the writer's position and circumstances, for all their reflected worth and, I hope, value, so unobscure as to warrant the hope that he will ever see you in person, or you he. Worth reflected from and value rendered to two persons of birth and position, one of whom, a lady and widowed mother, resides in that seclusion befitting her condition in the city from which this letter is inscribed, the other of whom, a young gentleman, her son, will either be as you read this or will shortly thereafter be a petitioner before the same bar of knowledge and wisdom as yourself. It is in his behalf that I write. No, I will not say behalf. Certainly I shall not let his lady mother nor the young gentleman himself suspect that I used that term, even to one, sir, scion of the principal family of that county, as it is your fortunate lot to be. Indeed, it were better for me if I had not written at all. But I do, I have. It is irrevocable now. If you discern aught in this letter which smacks of humility, take it as coming not from the mother and certainly not from the son, but from the pen of one whose humble position as legal adviser and man of business to the above-described lady and young gentleman, whose loyalty and gratitude toward one whose generosity has found him—I do not confess this, I proclaim it—in bread and meat and fire and shelter over a period long enough to have taught him gratitude and loyalty, even if he had not known them, has led him into an action whose means fall behind its intention for the reason that he is only what he is and professes himself to be, not what he would. So take this, sir, neither as the unwarranted insolence which an unsolicited communication from myself to you would be, not as a plea for sufferance on behalf of an unknown, but as an introduction, clumsy though it be, to one young gentleman whose position needs neither detailing nor recapitulation in the place where this letter is read, of another young gentleman whose position requires neither detailing nor recapitulation in the place where it was written. Not goodbye, all right, who had had so many fathers as to have neither love nor pride to receive or inflict, neither honor nor shame to share or bequeath, to whom one place was the same as another, like to a cat, cosmopolitan New Orleans or bucolic Mississippi, his own inherited and heritable Florentine lamps and gilded toilet seats and tufted mirrors, or a little jerkwater college not 10 years old, champagne in the octoroon's boudoir or whiskey on a harsh new table in a monk's cell and a country youth, a bucolic heir apparent who had probably never spent a dozen nights outside of his paternal house, unless perhaps to lie fully dressed beside a fire in the woods listening to dogs running, until he came to school, whom he watched aping his clothing, carriage, speech, and all, and, the youth, completely unaware that he was doing it, who, the youth, over the bottle one night, said, blurted—no, not blurted, it would be fumbling, groping. And he, the cosmopolite, 10 years the youth's senior almost, lounging in one of the silk robes, the like of which the youth had never seen before and believed that only women wore. Watching the youth blush fiery red, yet still face him, still look him straight in the eye while he fumbled, groped, blurted with abrupt, complete irrelevance. If I had a brother, I wouldn't want him to be a younger brother. And he, ah, and the youth, No, I would want him to be older than me. And he, no son of a landed father, wants an older brother. And the youth, yes, I do, looking straight at the other, the esoteric, the sybarite, standing, the youth now erect, thin, because he was young, his face scarlet but his head high and his eyes steady. Yes, and I would want him to be just like you. And he, is that so? The whiskey's your side, drink or pass. And now, Shreve said, we're going to talk about love. But he didn't need to say that either, any more than he had needed to specify which he meant by he, since neither of them had been thinking about anything else. All that had gone before, just so much that had to be overpassed, and none else present to overpass it but them, as someone always has to rake the leaves up before you can have the bonfire. That was why it did not matter to either of them which one did the talking, since it was not the talking alone which did it, performed and accomplished the overpassing, but some happy marriage of speaking and hearing, wherein each before the demand, the requirement, forgave, condoned, and forgot the faulting of the other, faultings both in the creating of this shade whom they discussed, rather existed in, and in the hearing and sifting and discarding the false and conserving what seemed true, or fit the preconceived, in order to overpass to love, where there might be paradox and inconsistency, but nothing fault nor false. And now, love. He must have known all about her before he ever saw her, what she looked like, her private hours in that provincial women's world that even men of the family were not supposed to know a great deal about. He must have learned it without even having to ask a single question. Jesus, it must have kind of boiled out all over him. There must have been nights and nights while Henry was learning from him how to lounge about a bedroom in a gown and slippers, such as women wore, in a faint though unmistakable effluvium of scent such as women used, smoking a cigar almost as a woman might smoke it, yet with all such an air of indolent and lethal assurance that only the most reckless man would have gratuitously drawn the comparison, and with no attempt to teach, train, play the mentor on his part. And then maybe yes, maybe who could know what times he looked at Henry's face and thought, not there but for the intervening leaven of that blood which we do not have in common is my skull, my brow, sockets, shape, and angle of jaw, and chin, and some of my thinking behind it, and which he could see in my face in his turn if he but knew to look as I know. But there, just behind a little, obscured a little by that alien blood whose admixing was necessary in order that he exist, is the face of the man who shaped us both out of that blind, chancy darkness which we call the future. There, there, at any moment, second, I shall penetrate by something of will and intensity and dreadful need, and strip that alien leavening from it, and look not on my brother's face whom I did not know I possessed, and hence never missed, but my father's, out of the shadow of whose absence my spirit's posthumeity has never escaped. At what moment, thinking, watching the eagerness which was without abjectness, the humility which surrendered no pride, the entire proffering of the spirit of which the unconscious aping of clothes and speech and mannerisms was but the shell, thinking, what cannot I do with this willing flesh and bone if I wish, this flesh and bone and spirit which stemmed from the same source that mine did, but which sprang in quiet peace and contentment and ran in steady, even though monotonous sunlight, where that which he bequeathed me sprang in hatred and outrage and unforgiving and ran in shadow. What could I not mold of this malleable and eager clay which that father himself could not? To what shape of what good there might, must be in that blood, and none handy to take and mold that portion of it in me until too late? Or what moments when he might have told himself that it was nonsense, it could not be true, that such coincidences only happen in books, thinking, the weariness, the fatalism, the incorrigible cat for solitude. That young clodhopper bastard, how shall I get rid of him? And then the voice, the other voice, you don't mean that. And he, no, but I do mean the clodhopper bastard. And the days, the afternoons, while they rode together, and Henry aping him here too, who was the better horseman, who maybe had nothing of what Bond would have called style, but who had done more of it, to whom a horse was as natural as walking, who would ride anything anywhere and at anything. While he must have watched himself being swamped and submerged in the bright unreal flood of Henry's speech, translated, the three of them, himself and Henry, and the sister whom he had never seen and perhaps did not even have any curiosity to see, into a world like a fairy tale in which nothing else save them existed. Riding beside Henry, listening, needing to ask no questions, to prompt to further speech in any manner that youth who did not even suspect that he and the man beside him might be brothers, who each time his breath crossed his vocal cords was saying, "From now on, mine and my sister's house will be your house, and mine and my sister's lives your life." Wondering, Bon, or maybe not wondering at all, how if conditions were reversed and Henry was the stranger and he, Bon, the scion, and still knew what he suspected, if he would say the same. Then Bon, agreeing at last, saying at last, "All right, I'll come home with you for Christmas." Not to see the third inhabitant of Henry's fairy tale, not to see the sister, because he had not once thought of her. He had merely listened about her, but thinking, "So at last I shall see him whom it seems I was bred up never to expect to see, whom I had even learned to live without." Thinking maybe how he would walk into the house and see the man who had made him, and then he would know. There would be that flash, that instant of indisputable recognition between them, and he would know for sure and forever. Thinking maybe, "That's all I want. He need not even acknowledge me. I will let him understand just as quickly that he need not do that, that I do not expect that, will not be hurt by that, just as he will let me know that quickly that I am his son." Thinking maybe, maybe again with that expression you might call smiling, but which was not, which was just something that even just a clodhopper bastard was not intended to see beyond. "I am my mother's son, at least. I do not seem to know what I want either." Because he knew exactly what he wanted. It was just the saying of it, the physical touch, even though in secret, hidden. The living touch of that flesh warmed before he was born by the same blood which it had bequeathed him to warm his own flesh with. To be bequeathed by him in turn to run hot and loud in veins and limbs after that first flesh and then his own were dead. So the Christmas came, and he and Henry rode the 40 miles to Sutpen's Hundred, with Henry still talking, still keeping distended and light and iridescent with steady breathing that fairy balloon vacuum in which the three of them existed, lived, moved even maybe, in attitudes without flesh. Himself, and the friend, and the sister whom the friend had never seen and, though Henry did not know it, had not even thought about yet, but only listened about from behind the more urgent thinking, and Henry probably not even noticing that the nearer they came to home, the less Bon talked, had to say on any subject, and maybe even, and certainly Henry would not know this, listening less. And went into the house, and maybe somebody looking at him would have seen on his face an expression a good deal like the one, that proffering with humility yet with pride too of complete surrender, which he had used to see on Henry's face, and maybe he telling himself, "I not only don't know what it is I want, but apparently I am a good deal younger than I thought also." And saw face to face the man who might be his father. And nothing happened. No shock, no hot communicated flesh that speech would have been too slow even to impede. Nothing. And he spent 10 days there, not only the esoteric, the sybarite, the steel blade in the silken tessellated sheath which Henry had begun to ape at the university, but the object of art, the mold and mirror of form and fashion which Mrs. Sutpen, so your father said, accepted him as, and insisted, didn't your father say, that he be, and would have purchased him as and paid for him with Judith even, if there had been no other bidder among the four of them, or didn't your father say? And which he did remain to her until he disappeared, taking Henry with him, and she never saw him again, and war and trouble and grief and bad food filled her days, until maybe she didn't even remember after a while that she had ever forgot him. And the girl, the sister, the virgin, Jesus, who to know what she saw that afternoon when they rode up the drive? What prayer, what maiden meditative dream ridden up out of whatever fabulous land? Not in harsh stove iron, but the silken and tragic Lancelot nearing 30. 10 years older than she was and wearied, sated with what experiences and pleasures which Henry's letters must have created for her. And the day came to depart, and no sign yet. He and Henry rode away, and still no sign, no more sign at parting than when he had seen it first. In that face where he might, he would believe, have seen for himself the truth, and so would have needed no sign, if it hadn't been for the beard. No sign in the eyes which could see his face, because there was no beard to hide it, could have seen the truth if it were there, yet no flicker in them. And so he knew it was in his face, because he knew that the other had seen it there just exactly as Henry was to know the next Christmas Eve in the library, that his father was not lying by the fact that the father said nothing, did nothing. Maybe he even thought, wondered, if perhaps that was not why the beard. If maybe the other had not hidden behind that beard against this very day. And if so, why? Why? Thinking, but why? Why? Since he wanted so little. Could have understood if the other had wanted the signal to be in secret. Would have been quick and glad to let it be in secret, even if he could not have understood why. Thinking in the middle of this, my God, I am young, young, and I didn't even know it. They didn't even tell me that I was young. Feeling that same despair and shame like when you have to watch your father fail in physical courage, thinking, it should have been me that failed. Me, I, not he who stemmed from that blood which we both bear before it could have become corrupt and tainted by whatever it was in mothers that he could not brook. Wait, Shreve cried, though Quentin had not spoken. It had been merely some quality, some gathering of Quentin's still laxed and hunched figure which presaged speech. Because Shreve said, wait, wait, before Quentin could have begun to speak. Because he hadn't even looked at her. Oh, he had seen her all right. He had had plenty of opportunity for that. He could not have helped but that because Mrs. Sutphen would have seen to it. 10 days of that kind of planned and arranged and executed privacies, like the campaigns of dead generals in the textbooks, in libraries and parlors and drives in the buggy in the afternoons. All planned 3 months ago when Mrs. Sutphen read Henry's first letter with Bond's name in it, until maybe even Judith too began to feel like the other one to a pair of goldfish. And him even talking to her too, or what talking he could have found to do to a country girl who probably never saw a man young or old before who sooner or later didn't smell like manure. Talking to her about like he would talk to the old dame on the gold chairs in the parlor. Except that in the one case he would have to make all the conversation, and in the other he would not even be able to make his own escape, but would have to wait for Henry to come and get him. And maybe he had even thought about her by that time, maybe at the times when he would be telling himself, it can't be so. He could not look at me like this every day and make no sign if it were so. He would even tell himself she would be easy. Like when you have left the champagne on the supper table and are walking toward the whiskey on the sideboard, and you happen to pass a cup of lemon sherbet on a tray, and you look at the sherbet and tell yourself, that would be easy too, only who wants it? Does that suit you? But it's not love, Quentin said. Because why not? Because listen. Wasn't it the old dame, the Aunt Rosa, told you about how there are some things that just have to be whether they are or not? Have to be a damn sight more than some other things that maybe are, and it don't matter a damn whether they are or not. That was it. He just didn't have time yet. Jesus, he must have known it would be. Like that lawyer thought, he wasn't a fool. The trouble was, he wasn't the kind of not fool the lawyer thought he would be. He must have known it was going to happen. It would be like you passed that sherbet, and maybe you knew you would even reach the sideboard and the whiskey, yet you knew that tomorrow morning you would want that sherbet. Then you reached the whiskey and you knew you wanted that sherbet now. Maybe you didn't even go to the sideboard. Maybe you even looked back at that champagne on the supper table among the dirty Haviland and the crumpled damask. And all of a sudden you knew you didn't want to go back there even. It would be no question of choosing, having to choose, between the champagne or whiskey and the sherbet. But all of a sudden, it would be spring then, in that country where he had never spent a spring before, and you said North Mississippi is a little harder country than Louisiana, with dogwood and violets and the early scentless flowers, but the earth and the nights still a little cold, and the hard, tight, sticky buds like young girls' nipples on alder and Judas trees and beech and maple, and even something young in the cedars like he never saw before. You find that you don't want anything but that sherbet, and that you haven't been wanting anything else but that, and you've been wanting that pretty hard for some time, besides knowing that that sherbet is there for you to take. Not just for anybody to take, but for you to take. knowing just from looking at that cup that it would be like a flower that, if any other hand reached for it, it would have thorns on it, but not for your hand. And him not used to that, since all the other cups that had been willing and easy for him to take up hadn't contained sherbet but champagne, or at least kitchen wine. And more than that, there was the knowing what he suspected might be so, or not knowing if it was so or not. And who to say if it wasn't maybe the possibility of incest? Because who, without a sister, I don't know about the others, has been in love and not discovered the vain evanescence of the fleshly encounter? Who has not had to realize that when the brief is all done, you must retreat from both love and pleasure, gather up your own rubbish and refuse, the hats and pants and shoes which you drag through the world, and retreat, since the gods condone and practice these, and the dreamy, immeasurable coupling which floats oblivious above the trammeling and harried instant. The was-not-is-was is a perquisite only of balloony and weightless elephants and whales. But maybe if there were sin, too, maybe you would not be permitted to escape, uncouple, return. Ain't that right? He ceased. He could have been interrupted easily now. Quentin could have spoken now, but Quentin did not. He just sat as before, his hands in his trousers pockets, his shoulders hugged inward and hunched, his face lowered, and he looked somehow curiously smaller than he actually was because of his actual height and spareness. That quality of delicacy about the bones, articulation, which even at 20 still had something about it, some last echo about it of adolescence. That is, as compared with the cherubic burliness of the other who faced him, who looked younger, whose very superiority in bulk and displacement made him look even younger, as a plump boy of 12 who outweighs the other by 20 or 30 pounds still looks younger than the boy of 14, who had that plumpness once and lost it, sold it, whether with his consent or not, for that state of virginity which is neither boys nor girls. "I don't know," Quentin said. "All right," Shreve said, "maybe I don't either. Only, Jesus, some day you are bound to fall in love. They just wouldn't beat you that way. It would be like if God had got Jesus born and saw that he had the carpenter tools and then never gave him anything to build with them. Don't you believe that?" "I don't know," Quentin said. He did not move. Shreve looked at him. Even while they were not talking, their breaths in the tomb-like air vaporized gently and quietly. The chimes for midnight would have rung some time ago now. "You mean it don't matter to you?" Quentin did not answer. "That's right, don't say it, because I would know you are lying." "All right then, listen. Because he never had to worry about the love, because that would take care of itself. Maybe he knew there was a fate, a doom on him, like what the old Aunt Rosa told you about some things that just have to be, whether they are or not, just to balance the books. Write paid on the old sheet so that whoever keeps them can take it out of the ledger and burn it, get rid of it. Maybe he knew then that whatever the old man had done, whether he meant well or ill by it, it wasn't going to be the old man who would have to pay the check. And now that the old man was bankrupt with the incompetence of age, who should do the paying if not his sons, his get? Because wasn't it done that way in the old days? The old Abraham, full of years and weak and incapable now of further harm, caught at last, and the captains and the collectors saying, 'Old man, we don't want you.' And Abraham would say, 'Praise the Lord, I have raised about me sons to bear the burden of mine iniquities and persecutions. Yea, perhaps even to restore my flocks and herds from the hand of the ravisher, that I might rest mine eyes upon my goods and chattels, upon the generations of them and of my descendants increased an hundredfold as my soul goeth out from me.' He knew all the time that the love would take care of itself. Maybe that was why he didn't have to think about her during those 3 months between that September and that Christmas, while Henry talked about her to him, saying every time he breathed, 'Hers and my lives are to exist within and upon yours.' Did not need to waste any time over the love after it happened, backfired on him. Why he never bothered to write her any letters, except that last one, which she would want to save. Why he never actually proposed to her and gave her a ring for Mrs. Sutphen to show around. Because the fate was on her, too. The same old Abraham, who was so old and weak now, nobody would want him in the flesh on any debt. Maybe he didn't even have to wait for that Christmas to see her to know this. Maybe that's what it was that came out of the 3 months of Henry's talking that he heard without listening to. I am not hearing about a young girl, a virgin. I am hearing about a narrow, delicate, fenced virgin field already furrowed and bedded so that all I shall need to do is drop the seeds in, caress it smooth again. Saw her that Christmas and knew it for certain and then forgot it, went back to school and did not even remember that he had forgotten it, because he did not have time then. Maybe it was just one day in that spring you told about when he stopped and said, right quiet, "All right, I want to go to bed with who might be my sister, all right." And then forgot that too, because he didn't have time. That is, he didn't have anything else but time, because he had to wait. But not for her. That was all fixed. It was the other. Maybe he thought it would be in the mailbag each time the nigger rode over from Sutpen's Hundred, and Henry, believing it was the letter from her that he was waiting for, when what he was thinking was, maybe he will write it then. He would just have to write, "I am your father, burn this, and I would do it." Or if not that, a sheet of scrap paper with the one word Charles in his hand, and I would know what he meant and he would not even have to ask me to burn it. Or a lock of his hair or a paring from his fingernail, and I would know them, because I believe now that I have known what his hair and his fingernails would look like all my life, could choose that lock and that paring out of 1,000. And it did not come, and his letter went to her every 2 weeks, and hers came back to him, and maybe he thought, if one of mine to her should come back to me unopened, then that would be a sign. And that didn't happen. And then Henry began to talk about his stopping at Sutpen's Hundred for a day or so on his way home, and he said all right to it, said, it will be Henry who will get the letter saying it is inconvenient for me to come at that time. So apparently he does not intend to acknowledge me as his son, but at least I shall have forced him to admit that I am. And that one did not come either, and the date was set, and the family at Sutpen's Hundred notified of it, and that letter did not come either, and he thought, it will be then. I wronged him. Maybe this is what he has been waiting for. And maybe his heart sprang then. Maybe he said, yes, yes, I will renounce her. I will renounce love and all. That will be cheap, cheap. Even though he say to me, never look upon my face again, take my love and my acknowledgement in secret and go, I will do that. I will not even demand to know of him what it was my mother did that justified his action toward her and me. So the day came, and he and Henry rode the 40 miles again, into the gates and up the drive to the house. He knew what would be there. The woman whom he had seen once and seen through, the girl whom he had seen through without even having to see once, the man whom he had seen daily, watched out of his fearful intensity of need and had never penetrated. The mother who had taken Henry aside before they had been 6 hours in the house on that Christmas visit and informed him of the engagement almost before the fiancé had had time to associate the daughter's name with the daughter's face. So that probably before they even reached school again, and without his being aware that he had done so, Henry had already told Bonn what was in his mother's mind, who had already told Bonn what was in his. So that maybe before they even started on Bonn's second visit, it would be June now, and what would it be in North Mississippi? What was it you said? The magnolias in bloom and the mockingbirds. And in 50 years more, after they had gone and fought it and lost it and come back home, the decoration day and the veterans in the neat brushed hand-ironed gray and the spurious bronze medals that never meant anything to begin with, and the chosen young girls in white dresses bound at the waist with crimson sashes, and the band would play Dixie, and all the old doddering men would yell that you would not have thought would have had wind enough to get there, walk downtown to sit on the rostrum even. It would be June now, with the magnolias and mockingbirds in the moonlight and the curtains blowing in the June air of commencement, and the music, fiddles and triangles, inside among the swirling and dipping hoops. And Henry would be a little tight, that should have been saying, I demand to know your intentions toward my sister, but wasn't saying it, instead maybe blushing again even in the moonlight, but standing straight and blushing because when you are proud enough to be humble you don't have to cringe. Who every time he breathed over his vocal cords he was saying, we belong to you, do as you will with us. Saying, I used to think that I would hate the man that I would have to look at every day and whose every move and action and speech would say to me, I have seen and touched parts of your sister's body that you will never see and touch, and now I know that I shall hate him, and that's why I want that man to be you." Knowing that Bon would know what he meant, was trying to say, tell him, thinking, telling himself, Henry, "Not just because he is older than I am and has known more than I shall ever know and has remembered more of it, but because of my own free will, and whether I knew it at the time or not does not matter, I gave my life and Judith's both to him." "That's still not love," Quentin said. "All right," Shreve said. "Just listen. Rode the 40 miles and into the gates and up to the house. And this time Sutphen wasn't even there. And Ellen didn't even know where he had gone, believing blandly and volubly that he had gone to Memphis or maybe even to St. Louis on business, and Henry and Judith not even caring that much, and only he, Bon, to know where Sutphen had gone, saying to himself, of course, he wasn't sure, he had to go there to make sure. Telling himself that loud now, loud and fast, too, so he would not, could not, hear the thinking, the, but if he suspected, why not have told me? I would have done that, gone to him first, who have the blood after it was tainted and corrupt by whatever it was in mother. Loud and fast now, telling himself, that's what it is. Maybe he has gone on ahead to wait for me. He left no message for me here because the others are not to suspect yet, and he knows that I will know at once where he is when I find him gone. Thinking of the two of them, the somber, vengeful woman who was his mother and the grim, rock-like man who had looked at him every day for 10 days with absolutely no alteration of expression at all, facing one another in grim armistice after almost 30 years in that rich Baroque drawing-room in that house which he called home, since apparently everybody seemed to have a home, the man who he was now sure was his father, not humble now either, and he, Bon, proud of that, not saying even now, I was wrong, but I admit that it is so. Jesus, think of his heart then, during those 2 days, with the old gal throwing Judith at him every minute now because she had been spreading the news of the engagement confidentially through the county ever since Christmas. Didn't your father say how she had even taken Judith to Memphis in the spring to buy the trousseau? And Judith, neither having to accede to the throwing nor to resist it, but just being, just existing and breathing like Henry did, who maybe one morning during that spring waked up and lay right still in the bed and took stock, added the figures and drew the balance and told himself, all right, I am trying to make myself into what I think he wants me to be. He can do anything he wants to with me. He has only to tell me what to do and I will do it. Even though what he asked me to do looked to me like dishonor, I would still do it. Only Judith, being a female and so wiser than that, would not even consider dishonor. She would just say, all right, I will do anything he might ask me to do, and that is why he will never ask me to do anything that I consider dishonorable. So that, maybe he even kissed her that time, the first time she had ever been kissed maybe, and she too innocent to be coy or modest or even to know that she had been temporized with. Maybe afterward just looking at him with a kind of peaceful and blank surprise at the fact that your sweetheart apparently kissed you the first time like your brother would, provided, of course, that your brother ever thought of could be brought to kissing you on the mouth. So that when the 2 days were up and he was gone again, and Ellen shrieking at her, what? No engagement? No troth? No ring? She would be too astonished even to lie about it, because that would be the first time it would have occurred to her that there had been no proposal. Think of his heart then, while he rode to the river, and then on the steamboat itself where he walked up and down the deck, feeling through the deck the engines driving him nearer and nearer day and night to the moment which he must have realized now he had been waiting for ever since he had got big enough to comprehend. Of course, every now and then he would just have to say it pretty fast and loud. That's all it is. He just wants to make sure first. To drown out the old, but why do it this way? Why not back there? He knows that I shall never make any claim upon any part of what he now possesses, gained at the price of what sacrifice and endurance and scorn, so they told me, not he, they, only he knows that so well that it would never have occurred to him, just as he knows it would never occur to me that this might be his reason, who is not only generous but ruthless, who must have surrendered everything he and mother owned to her and to me as the price of repudiating her. Not because the doing it this way hurt him, flouted him and kept him in suspense that much unnecessary longer, because he didn't matter, whether he was irked or even crucified didn't matter. It was the fact that he had to be kept constantly reminded that he would not have done it this way himself. Yet he had stemmed from the blood after whatever it was his mother had been or done had tainted and corrupted it. Nearer and nearer, until suspense and puzzlement and haste and all seemed blended into one sublimation of passive surrender, in which he thought only, all right, even this way, even if he wants to do it this way, I will promise never to see her again, never to see him again. Then he reached home, and he never learned if Sutphen had been there or not. He never knew. He believed it, but he never knew. His mother, the same somber, unchanged, fierce paranoiac whom he had left in September, from whom he could learn nothing by indirection and whom he dared not ask outright. The very fact that he saw through the skillful questions of the lawyer as to how he had liked the school and the people of that country and how perhaps, or had he not perhaps, he had made friends up there among the country families, only that much more proof to him at that time that Sutphen had not been there, or at least the lawyer was not aware that he had, since now that he believed he had fathomed the lawyer's design in sending him to that particular school to begin with, he saw nothing in the questions to indicate that the lawyer had learned anything new since. Or what he could have learned in that interview with the lawyer, because it would be a short one. It would be next to the shortest one ever to transpire between them, the shortest one of all next to the last one, of course, the one which would occur in the next summer, when Henry would be with him. Because the lawyer would not dare risk asking him outright, just as he, Bond, did not dare to ask his mother outright. Because, though the lawyer believed him to be rather a fool than dull or dense, yet even he, the lawyer, never for one moment believed that even Bond was going to be the kind of a fool he was going to be. So he told the lawyer nothing, and the lawyer told him nothing, and the summer passed, and September came, and still the lawyer, his mother, too, had not once asked him if he wanted to return to the school, so that at last he had to say to himself that he intended to return. And maybe he knew that he had lost that move, since there was nothing whatever in the lawyer's face save an agent's acquiescence. So he returned to school, where Henry was waiting, oh yes, waiting for him, who did not even say, "You didn't answer my letters, you didn't even write to Judith," who had already said, "What my sister and I have and are belongs to you." But maybe he did write to Judith now, by the first nigger post which rode to Sutphen's Hundred, about how it had been an uneventful summer and hence nothing to write about, with maybe Charles Bond plain and inalightable on the outside of the envelope, and he thinking he will have to see that. Maybe he will send it back, thinking, maybe if it comes back nothing will stop me then, and so maybe at last I will know what I am going to do. But it didn't come back. And the others didn't come back. And the fall passed, and Christmas came, and they rode again to Sutphen's Hundred, and this time he was not there again. He was in the field, he had gone to town, he was hunting, something. Sutphen not there when they rode up, and Bond knew he had not expected him to be there, saying, "Now, now, now, it will come now, it will come this time, and I am young, young, because I still don't know what I am going to do." So maybe what he was doing that twilight, because he knew that Sutphen had returned, was now in the house. It would be like a wind, something, dark and chill, breathing upon him, and he stopping, grave, quiet, alert, thinking, what is it? Then he would know. He could feel the other entering the house. And he would let his held breath go quiet and easy, a profound exhalation, his heart quiet too. In the garden, while he walked with Judith and talked to her, gallant and elegant and automatic, and Judith thinking about that like she thought about that first kiss back in the summer. So that's it, that's what love is. Bludgeoned once more by disappointment, but still unbowed. Maybe what he was doing there now was waiting, telling himself, maybe even yet he will send for me. At least say it to me, even though he knew better. He is in the library now, he has sent the nigger for Henry, now Henry is entering the room. So that maybe he stopped and faced her, with something in his face that was smiling now, and took her by the elbows and turned her, easy and gentle, until she faced the house, and said, "Go, I wish to be alone to think about love." And she went just as she took the kiss that day, with maybe the feel of the flat of his hand light and momentary upon her behind. And he stood there facing the house until Henry came out, and they looked at one another for a while with no word said, and then turned and walked together through the garden, across the lot and into the stable, where maybe there was a nigger there, and maybe they saddled the two horses themselves and waited until the house nigger came with the two repacked saddlebags. And maybe he didn't even say then, but he sent no word to me. Shreve ceased. That is, for all the two of them, Shreve and Quentin knew he had stopped, since for all the two of them knew he had never begun, since it did not matter, and possibly neither of them conscious of the distinction, which one had been doing the talking. So that now it was not two, but four of them riding the two horses through the dark over the frozen December ruts of that Christmas Eve. Four of them, and then just two, Charles Shreve and Quentin Henry, the two of them both believing that Henry was thinking he, meaning his father, has destroyed us all, not for one moment thinking he, meaning Bon, must have known or at least suspected this all the time. That's why he has acted as he has, why he did not answer my letters last summer nor write to Judith, why he has never asked her to marry him. Believing that that must have occurred to Henry, certainly during that moment after Henry emerged from the house and he and Bon looked at one another for a while without a word, then walked down to the stable and saddled the horses, but that Henry had just taken that in stride because he did not yet believe it, even though he knew that it was true, because he must have now understood with complete despair the secret of his whole attitude toward Bon from that first instinctive moment when he had seen him a year and a quarter ago. He knew, yet he did not, had to refuse to, believe. So it was four of them who rode the two horses through that night and then across the bright frosty North Mississippi Christmas Day, in something very like pariahhood, passing the plantation houses with sprigs of holly thrust beneath the knockers on the doors and mistletoe hanging from the chandeliers and bowls of eggnog and toddy on tables in the halls and the blue unwinded wood smoke standing above the plastered chimneys of the slave quarters, to the river and the steamboat. There would be Christmas on the boat, too, the same holly and mistletoe, the same eggnog and toddy. Perhaps, doubtless, a Christmas supper and a ball, but not for them. The two of them in the dark and the cold, standing at the guardrail above the dark water, and still not talking since there was nothing to say. The two of them, the four of them, held in that probation, that suspension, by Henry, who knew but still did not believe, who was going deliberately to look upon and prove to himself that which, so Shreve and Quentin believed, would be like death for him to learn. So it was four of them still who got off the boat in New Orleans, which Henry had never seen before, whose entire cosmopolitan experience, apart from his sojourn at the school, consisted probably of one or two trips to Memphis with his father to buy livestock or slaves, and had no time to look at now. Henry, who knew yet did not believe, and Bon, whom Mr. Compson had called a fatalist, but who, according to Shreve and Quentin, did not resist Henry's dictum and design for the reason that he neither knew nor cared what Henry intended to do, because he had long since realized that he did not yet know what he himself was going to do. Four of them, who sat in that drawing-room of baroque and fusty magnificence which Shreve had invented and which was probably true enough, while the Haiti-born daughter of the French sugar planter and the woman who Sutpen's first father-in-law had told him was a Spaniard, the slight dowdy woman with untidy gray-streaked raven hair coarse as a horse's tail, with parchment-colored skin and implacable pouched black eyes which alone showed no age because they showed no forgetting, whom Shreve and Quentin had likewise invented and which was likewise probably true enough, told them nothing because she did not need to because she had already told it, who did not say, "My son is in love with your sister," but, "So she has fallen in love with him," and then sat laughing harshly and steadily at Henry, who could not have lied to her even if he would have, who did not even have to answer at all either yes or no. Four of them there, in that room in New Orleans in 1860, just as in a sense there were four of them here in this tomb-like room in Massachusetts in 1910. And Bon may have, probably did, take Henry to call on the octoroon mistress and the child, as Mr. Compson said, though neither Shreve nor Quentin believed that the visit affected Henry as Mr. Compson seemed to think. In fact, Quentin did not even tell Shreve what his father had said about the visit. Perhaps Quentin himself had not been listening when Mr. Compson related, recreated, it that evening at home. Perhaps at that moment, on the gallery in the hot September twilight, Quentin took that in stride without even hearing it, just as Shreve would have, since both he and Shreve believed, and were probably right in this too, that the octoroon and the child would have been to Henry only something else about Bond to be not envied but aped, if that had been possible, if there had been time and peace to ape it in. Peace not between men of the same race and nation, but peace between two young embattled spirits and the incontrovertible fact which embattled them. Since neither Henry and Bond, any more than Quentin and Shreve, were the first young men to believe, or at least apparently act on the assumption, that wars were sometimes created for the sole aim of settling youth's private difficulties and discontents. So the old dame asked Henry that one question, and then sat there laughing at him. So he knew then, they both knew then. And so now it would be short, this time with the lawyer, the shortest one of all. Because the lawyer would have been watching him. Maybe there had even been a letter during that second fall, while the lawyer was waiting and still nothing seemed to be happening up there. And maybe the lawyer was the reason why Bond never answered Henry's and Judith's letters during that summer, because he never got them. A letter, two or maybe three pages of your humble and obedient E and T and C, that boiled down to 18 words. I know you are a fool, but just what kind of a fool are you going to be? And Bond was at least enough of a not-fool to do the boiling down. Yes, watching him, not concerned yet, just considerably annoyed, giving Bond plenty of time to come to him, giving him all of a week, maybe. After he, the lawyer, would have contrived to get hold of Henry and find out a good deal of what Henry was thinking without Henry ever knowing it, before he would contrive Bond too, and maybe so good at the contriving that even Bond would not know at once what was coming. It would be a short one. It would be no secret between them now. It would just be unsaid. The lawyer behind the desk, and maybe in the secret drawer, the ledger where he had just finished adding in the last past year's interest compounded between the intrinsic and the love and pride at 200%. The lawyer fretted, annoyed, but not at all concerned, since he not only knew he had the screws, but he still did not really believe that Bond was that kind of a fool, though he was about to alter his opinion somewhat about the dullness, or at least the backwardness. The lawyer watching him and saying, smooth and oily, since it would be no secret now, who would know now that Bond knew all he would ever know or would need to know, to make the coup? Do you know that you are a very fortunate young man? With most of us, even when we are lucky enough to get our revenge, we must pay for it, sometimes in actual dollars. While you are not only in a position to get your revenge, clear your mother's name, but the balm with which you will assuage her injury will have a collateral value which can be translated into the things which a young man needs, which are his due and which, whether we like it or not, may be had only in exchange for hard dollars. And Bond, not saying, "What do you mean?" and not moving yet, that is, the lawyer would not be aware that he was beginning to move, continuing, the lawyer, smooth and easy, "And more than this, than the revenge, is lagniap to the revenge, as it were. This nosegay of an afternoon, this scentless prairie flower which will not be missed and which might as well bloom in your lapel as in another's. This, how do you young men put it, a nice little piece?" And then he would see Bond, maybe the eyes, maybe he would just hear the feet moving. And then pistol, derringer, horse pistol, revolver, whatever it was, and all, he would be crouched back against the wall behind the overturned chair, snarling, "Stand back, stop!" Then screaming, "Help, help, help!" Then just screaming, because he could hear and feel his own wrenching bones before he could free his fingers of the pistol, and his neck bone too, as Bond would strike him with the palm on one cheek and then with the back of the hand on the other. Maybe he could even hear Bond too saying, "Stop it, hush, I'm not going to hurt you." Or maybe it was the lawyer in him that said the hush, which he obeyed, who got him back into the righted chair again, half lying upon the desk, the lawyer in him that warned him not to say, "You will pay for this," but instead to half lie there, nursing his wrenched hand in his handkerchief while Bond stood looking down at him, holding the pistol by the barrel against his leg, saying, "If you feel that you require satisfaction, of course you know." And the lawyer, sitting back now, dabbing the handkerchief at his cheek now, "I was wrong. I misunderstood your feeling about the matter. I ask your pardon." And Bond, "Granted. As you wish. I will accept either an apology or a bullet, as you prefer." And the lawyer, there would be a faint fading red in his cheek, but that would be all, nothing in the voice or in the eyes. "I see you are going to collect full measure for my unfortunate misconception, even ridicule. Even if I felt that right was on my side, which I do not, I would still have to decline your offer. I would not be your equal with pistols. And Bon, nor with knives or rapiers too, and the lawyer smooth and easy, nor knives or rapiers too. So that now the lawyer wouldn't even need to say you will pay for this, because Bon would be saying that for him, who would stand there with the lax pistol, thinking, but only with knives or pistols or rapiers. So I can't beat him. I could shoot him. I would shoot him with no more compunction than I would a snake or a man who cuckolded me, but he would still beat me, thinking, yes, he did beat me, while he...
Listen, Shreve said, cried.
It would be while he would be lying in a bedroom of that private house in Corinth after Pittsburgh Landing, while his shoulder got well 2 years later, and the letter from the Octoroon, maybe even the one that contained the photograph of her and the child, finally overtaking him, wailing for money and telling him that the lawyer had departed for Texas or Mexico or somewhere at last, and that she, the Octoroon, could not find his mother either, and so without doubt the lawyer had murdered her before he stole the money, since it would be just like both of them to flee or get themselves killed without providing for her at all. Yes, they knew now. And Jesus, think of him, Bon, who had wanted to know, who had had the most reason to want to know, who, as far as he knew, had never had any father but had been created somehow between that woman who wouldn't let him play with other children, and that lawyer who even told the woman whether or not each time she bought a piece of meat or a loaf of bread. Two people neither of whom had taken pleasure or found passion in getting him or suffered pain and travail in borning him. Who perhaps if one of the two had only told him the truth, none of what happened would ever have come to pass. While there was Henry, who had father and security and contentment and all, yet was told the truth by both of them while he, Bon, was told by neither. And think of Henry, who had said at first it was a lie, and then when he knew it was not a lie, had still said, I don't believe it. Who had found even in that I don't believe it enough of strength to repudiate home and blood in order to champion his defiance, and in which championing he proved his contention to be the false one, and was more than ever interdict against returning home. Jesus, think of the load he had to carry. Born of two Methodists, or of one long invincible line of Methodists, and raised in provincial North Mississippi, faced with incest, incest of all things that might have been reserved for him, that all his heredity and training had to rebel against on principle, and in a situation where he knew that neither incest nor training was going to help him solve it. So that maybe when they left and walked the streets that night and at last Bond said, well, now what? Henry said, wait, wait, let me get used to it. And maybe it was 2 days or 3 days, and Henry said, you shall not. And then it was Bond that said, wait, I am your older brother. Do you say shall not to me? And maybe it was a week, maybe Bond took Henry to see the Octoroon, and Henry looked at her and said, ain't that enough for you? And Bond said, do you want it to be enough? And Henry said, wait, wait, I must have time to get used to it. You will have to give me time. Jesus, think how Henry must have talked during that winter and then that spring, with Lincoln elected and the Alabama Convention, and the South began to draw out of the Union. And then there were two presidents in the United States, and the telegraph brought the news about Charleston, and Lincoln called out his army, and it was done, irrevocable now. And Henry and Bon already decided to go without having to consult one another, who would have gone anyway even if they had never seen one another, but certainly now, because after all you don't waste a war. Think how they must have talked, how Henry would say, but must you marry her? Do you have to do it? And Bon would say, he should have told me, myself, himself. I was fair and honorable with him, I waited. You know now why I waited. I gave him every chance to tell me himself, but he didn't do it. If he had, I would have agreed and promised never to see her or you or him again, but he didn't tell me. I thought at first it was because he didn't know. Then I knew that he did know, and still I waited. But he didn't tell me. He just told you. Sent me a message like you send a command by a nigger servant to a beggar or a tramp to clear out. Don't you see that? And Henry would say, but Judith, our sister, think of her. And Bon, all right, think of her. Then what? Because they both knew what Judith would do when she found it out. Because they both knew that women will show pride and honor about almost anything except love. And Henry said, yes, I see, I understand. But you will have to give me time to get used to it. You are my older brother, you can do that little for me. Think of the two of them, Bon, who didn't know what he was going to do and had to say, pretend he did, and Henry, who knew what he was going to do and had to say he didn't. Then it was Christmas again, then 1861, and they hadn't heard from Judith because Judith didn't know for sure where they were because Henry wouldn't let Bon write to her yet. Then they heard about the company, the University Greys, organizing up at Oxford, and maybe they had been waiting for that. So they took the steamboat north again, and more gaiety and excitement on the boat now than Christmas even, like it always is when a war starts, before the scene gets cluttered up with bad food and wounded soldiers and widows and orphans. And them taking no part in it now either, but standing at the rail again above the churning water. And maybe it would be 2 or 3 days. Then Henry said suddenly, cried suddenly, "But kings have done it, even dukes. There was that Lorraine duke named John something that married his sister. The Pope excommunicated him, but it didn't hurt. It didn't hurt. They were still husband and wife. They were still alive. They still loved." Then again, loud, fast, "But you will have to wait. You will have to give me time. Maybe the war will settle it, and we won't need to." And maybe this was one place where your old man was right. And they rode into Oxford without touching Sutpen's Hundred and signed the company roster and then hid somewhere to wait. And Henry let Bon write Judith one letter. They would send it by hand, by a nigger that would steal into the quarters by night and give it to Judith's maid. And Judith sent the picture in the metal case, and they rode on ahead to wait until the company got through making flags and riding about the state telling girls farewell and started for the front. Jesus, think of them. Because Bon would know what Henry was doing, just as he had always known what Henry was thinking since that first day when they had looked at one another. Maybe he would know all the better what Henry was doing because he did not know what he himself was going to do, that he would not know until all of a sudden someday it would burst clear, and he would know then that he had known all the time what it would be. So he didn't have to bother about himself, and so all he had to do was just to watch Henry trying to reconcile what he, Henry, knew he was going to do with all the voices of his heredity and training which said, "No, no, you cannot, you must not, you shall not." Maybe they would even be under fire now, with the shells rushing and rumbling past overhead and bursting, and them lying there waiting to charge, and Henry would cry again, "But that Lorraine Duke did it. There must have been lots in the world who have done it that people don't know about, that maybe they suffered for it and died for it and are in hell now for it, but they did it and it don't matter now. Even the ones we do know about are just names now and it don't matter now." And Bon, watching him and listening to him and thinking, "It's because I don't know myself what I am going to do, and so he is aware that I am undecided without knowing that he is aware. Perhaps if I told him now that I am going to do it, he would know his own mind and tell me, 'You shall not.'" And maybe your old man was right this time, and they did think maybe the war would settle it, and they would not have to themselves. Or at least maybe Henry hoped it would, because maybe your old man was right here too, and Bon didn't care. That since both of the two people who could have given him a father had declined to do it, nothing mattered to him now, revenge or love or all. Since he knew now that revenge could not compensate him nor love assuage. Maybe it wasn't even Henry who wouldn't let him write to Judith, but Bon himself who did not write her, because he didn't care about anything, not even that he didn't know yet what he was going to do. Then it was the next year, and Bon was an officer now, and they were moving toward Shiloh without knowing that either, talking again as they moved along in column, the officer dropping back alongside the file in which the private marched, and Henry crying again, holding his desperate and urgent voice down to undertone, "Don't you know yet what you are going to do?" While Bon would look at him for a moment with that expression which could have been smiling. "Suppose I told you I did not intend to go back to her." And Henry would walk there beside him with his pack and his 8 feet of musket, and he would begin to pant, panting and panting, while Bon watched him. "I am out in front of you a lot now, going into battle, charging. I will be out in front of you." And Henry panting, "Stop, stop." And Bon watching him with that faint, thin expression about the mouth and eyes. And who would ever know? You would not even have to know for certain yourself, because who could say but what a Yankee ball might have struck me at the exact second you pulled your trigger, or even before. And Henry panting and looking, glaring at the sky, with his teeth showing and the sweat on his face and the knuckles of the hand on his musket butt white, saying, panting, "Stop, stop, stop, stop." Then it was Shiloh, the second day, and the lost battle, and the brigade falling back from Pittsburgh Landing. "And listen," Shreve cried, "wait now, wait. glaring at Quentin, panting himself as if he had had to supply his shade not only with the cue but with breath to obey it in.
"Because your old man was wrong here, too. He said it was Bon who was wounded, but it wasn't. Because who told him? Who told Sutphen, or your grandfather either, which of them it was who was hit? Sutphen didn't know because he wasn't there, and your grandfather wasn't there either, because that was where he was hit, too, where he lost his arm. So who told them? Not Henry, because his father never saw Henry but that one time, and maybe they never had time to talk about wounds, and besides, to talk about wounds in the Confederate Army in 1865 would be like coal miners talking about soot. And not Bon, because Sutphen never saw him at all because he was dead. It was not Bon, it was Henry. Bon that found Henry at last and stooped to pick him up, and Henry fought back, struggled, saying, 'Let be, let me die, I won't have to know it then.' And Bond said, 'So do you want me to go back to her?' And Henry lay there struggling and panting, with the sweat on his face and his teeth bloody inside his chewed lip. And Bond said, 'Say you do want me to go back to her. Maybe then I won't do it. Say it.' And Henry lay there struggling, with the fresh red staining through his shirt and his teeth showing and the sweat on his face, until Bond held his arms and lifted him onto his back.
First two of them, then four, now two again. The room was indeed tomb-like, a quality stale and static and moribund beyond any mere vivid and living cold. Yet they remained in it, though not 30 feet away was bed and warmth. Quentin had not even put on his overcoat, which lay on the floor where it had fallen from the arm of the chair where Shreve had put it down. They did not retreat from the cold. They both bore it as though in deliberate, flagellant exaltation of physical misery transmogrified into the spirit's travail of the two young men during that time 50 years ago, or 48 rather, then 47 and then 46, since it was 64 and then 65, and the starved and ragged remnant of an army having retreated across Alabama and Georgia and into Carolina, swept onward not by a victorious army behind it, but rather by a mounting tide of the names of lost battles from either side, Chickamauga and Franklin, Vicksburg and Corinth and Atlanta. Battles lost not alone because of superior numbers and failing ammunition and stores, but because of generals who should not have been generals, who were generals not through training in contemporary methods or aptitude for learning them, but by the divine right to say, 'Go there,' conferred upon them by an absolute caste system, or because the generals of it never lived long enough to learn how to fight massed, cautious, accretionary battles, since they were already as obsolete as Richard or Roland or Du Guesclin, who wore plumes and cloaks lined with scarlet at 28 and 30 and 32 and captured warships with cavalry charges, but no grain nor meat nor bullets, who would whip 3 separate armies in as many days and then tear down their own fences to cook meat robbed from their own smokehouses, who on one night and with